look at Nazi Germany, and the roots were there. They were building up from the medieval time period. We're talking 500 years of this building to that point. So know your history, folks, because you don't want to repeat it.
Hello, and welcome to the Innovative Mindset Podcast. I'm your host, Isolde Trachtenberg. On the show, I interview peak-performing world changers in the creative, social impact, and vegan spaces. If you like what you hear on this episode, you're going to want to check out the bonus mini-episode that you can access if you DM me, at Isolde T on Instagram, and you let me know you want it. You'll get access to bonus episodes, new art, my latest writing, and other fun benefits. And now, let's get to the show. Hello, hello, and welcome to the Innovative Mindset Podcast. I'm your host, Isolde Trachtenberg. Super excited that you're here. I'm also really thrilled and honored to have this week's guest. Check out Jerry Westerson. LA native and award-winning author Jerry Westerson writes the critically acclaimed Crispin Guest medieval noir series, two urban fantasy series, a Gaslamp steampunk fantasy series, a rom-com LGBTQ mystery series, and numerous short stories in various mystery anthologies. Wow. To date, her medieval mysteries have garnered 13 industry award nominations from the Agatha to the Seamus. She has served as president of the SoCal, we're going to say Southern California, chapter of Mystery Writers of America, president of Sisters in Crime, Orange County, and vice president for Sisters in Crime, Los Angeles. She's also a member of the Historical Novel Society. I mean, wow. Jerry, thank you so much for being here. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
Oh, yay. I'm so glad to hear that. So I want to just jump right in. There are so many things about you. I've been doing my research. There are so many things about you that I think are amazing. One of which is, it looks to me like you were at one point being published by one of the big publishing companies and you left. And we've had a sort of book publishing revolution, like the music industry revolution, where the barriers to entry have really dropped or gone down a lot. And you've stated that you believe writers should come up with that different idea, write it, and get it out there. And I'm wondering if we can just start right off and talk about that. What do you mean by different or innovative idea? And I get the writing it part, but what do you mean by getting it out there? How should a writer do the innovative and different thing enough? And also, how do they get it out there?
Yeah. Well, you know, that is the question. First, I would recommend getting yourself a magic lamp, rubbing it vigorously, because that's the best way to do it. But there are other ways. I didn't just leave the big New York publisher. I was shown the door.
As many of us authors
have been. After you write a certain number of books and it's not hitting sales numbers that they want, then you are shown the door. And in many instances, years ago, that was the end of a series. That was the end of that. Uh-huh. But I was just there on the cusp of the self-publishing revolution. And my agent felt that we weren't done with the series. Yeah, I certainly wasn't. So he was going to be shopping it around to another publisher. But while he was doing that, and I knew it was going to take a while, I had a first in the series that wasn't published because it just wasn't, it was rejected by the big publisher. So I felt that I needed to have another book on the shelves during that time that my agent was searching for a new publisher. I didn't want a year to go by without another Crispin Guest book. So I dug that guy out of the vault and had it edited and rewrote a lot of it, and I self-published it. So I put my toe into the hybrid author moniker as a both traditionally and self-published author. And it did very well. In fact, it got two industry nominations, and it's still selling very well, called Cup of Blood. And that showed me that there are ways for authors to make strides into different markets, getting their names out there in different ways. Of course, the biggest way is networking. You got to network. I know there are a lot of authors who just want to put their heads down and just write by themselves in their little rooms with the door closed. I get that. I prefer to do that too. But we all have to market, and we have to market ourselves. Even when you are traditionally published by big New York publishers, you're still going to do the lion's share, unfortunately. So you got to network. And you mentioned the organizations, the writing organizations I belong to and I was president for. And those are good ways to start, finding those organizations. With social media, it's insane because that's your explosion. That's your opportunity right there to get on social media in all the different ways. Not all of them, you know, don't. I could hear people out there just cringing and sweating. Don't do that. Don't do that to yourself. Pick two that you really like, and then just really do some focusing. You don't have to spend a lot of money either, but you just do have to spend time. So there's that. There's so many ways, so many things to research, and it changes constantly. But, you know, if you network, if you're talking to other authors, some who are much better at social media, some who are much better at finding those different ways to get your name out there, get yourself out there, then that's how you learn. You know, don't buy books about it because those books are already out of date the moment you pick them up. So get out there and talk to people.
I love it. That's great advice. And for those who are introverts, you don't have to talk to everyone in the room. You might want to talk to one or two people in the room. So just be aware that there are probably ways to do that, even if you're shy or even if you're really introverted, like a lot of writers that I've met are. You and I are not, Terry.
No, we're not. And that was a good thing for me. But, you know, in these days of Zooming and, you know, it could be that those options will always still be there. I kind of hope they will be for people who can't be, you know, get to some of these meetings face to face when you really can. So hopefully that option always is available. But I always tell you, if you really are shy, volunteer in the different writing organizations. When we have festivals and you know, writers, author festivals, book festivals, volunteer to help set up booths and things like that. That's networking too. So, you know, if you want to still keep your head down a little bit, now you're learning some of the people, you're learning the board members' names, and you're talking to them and they're talking to you. That's a good way to start getting in there.
Oh, absolutely. In one of my books, I talk about knowing your role. And if you don't know it, choose one, right?
Yeah,
first thing you do, pick one up. Exactly. Volunteering is great. If you're going to an event, offer to be the person who takes people's coats, for example. Although out in LA, you might not need that so much because not too many coats.
What is this thing called coats?
I love it. So, you know, going back a little bit further, you had a successful career as a graphic artist and designer in LA, right? This city full of creativity and people thinking on the edge. And you let all of that go to become a novelist. What led to that? And how did you make that transition?
I was crazy. No. But I was sort of forced to make that transition. It's, you know, I think that in these modern times of ours, that you have to constantly reinvent yourself, constantly, because there's so much change. It just barrels forward towards us, and you have to go with it. So what happened was I was a graphic artist and art director in Los Angeles, pretty successful at it, really enjoying it. And then we're having a baby. And so I put that aside for a couple of years to raise my son. And in those 2 years, when I was trying to get back into it, thought I would get back into it because I could work at home. It was great. Everything had turned to computers. This is how long ago this was. And I had not. So
got it.
I didn't know anything about computer design. And to do that would have taken more time and money and, you know, get a computer, take some tutoring. And so that wasn't going to be viable for me at the time. So, excuse me, I had a long time hobby of writing novels that my husband didn't really know about. It was just something I did for fun. But I thought, well, here's something. I could stay at home, raise my son. I could write novels and make money. How hard could it be? So,
oh boy.
Yeah, there's a big learning curve there. When I told my husband this, that I wasn't going to get back into graphic design, I said, hey, you know what? I really think that I can be an historical novelist. I really would like to try that if I can get your support on this. And he goes, well, of course you have my support. I'd be willing to help you along with this. But the question is, do you write novels? Oh yeah, of course I do. Here's a whole box of them here. But no, so I researched, you know, you need an agent. And to get that agent, you had to have finished manuscripts. You had to have these manuscripts formatted properly. You had to learn how to pitch these in query letters. And again, these were in the days where you mailed them in the post office with stamps and things. And so I had learned all of that. And got that rolling and understood that it was going to take a while. So that was all learning curves, all things that you gotta do. And slowly, it took a while. My fourth agent was the one who got me published. So you can't think of these people as, you know, your pals, your friends. It's nice if you can, but these are business collaborations. If it doesn't work out, then you have to say goodbye to one another and move along to the next who can do something for you. You know, in the meantime, in the years, a decade, 14 years went by, not just with the same book, by the way.
Wow.
This was a new book every year that I was churning out. And these were all historical novels. And these were all historical novels that publishers couldn't understand because they weren't about Henry VIII. They weren't about famous people. They were about ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances with court life, court politics, tangential, all in the background. And that just didn't work for the kind of historical novels they wanted to publish 10, 15, 20 years ago. But a former agent talked to me. We were still friends. And she said, you know, you should write medieval mysteries because mystery is a bigger market. There are conventions devoted to fans of mysteries. There are bookstores that just sell mysteries. There are imprints that just publish mysteries. And I thought, well, I don't know how to write a mystery. I guess I'll learn. So I did, and I the kind of mystery I wanted to write was sort of a hard-boiled mystery, but set in the medieval time period. So I literally took apart one of my favorite hard-boiled books, The Maltese Falcon.
Great book.
And it's a fantastic book with great, well-written characters in it throughout. And so I literally did take it apart chapter by chapter, beat by beat, you know, what made up a mystery. And one of the things I actually liked about the Maltese Falcon was the falcon itself. That, I felt, added this extra something. You know, everybody was after this thing. And then they got it, and spoiler alert, it wasn't the falcon they were looking for. So, sorry, folks. Yeah, I've read it. But so I incorporated the idea of that in these medieval mysteries with my hard-boiled detective, Crispin Guest, who had lost everything. He was a knight. and a lord, and he lost everything and had to eke out a living on the mean streets of 14th century London as a detective for hire called the Tracker. And he would always come upon a religious relic or venerated object that was basically my falcon. And that added another dimension to the books that was either something that you focused on completely as the main focus of the book, or it was something that started off the action, but everything moved off from there, or it was something so tangential that it was barely mentioned. So, you know, so you sort of mix it up a little. You're not having the same plotting thing every time. So it was just a matter of going for something different. And that's what got me published. Like, as soon as I changed to that, it was like right away. So I just had to find my right level, my right place to be. And mystery turned out to be that.
I'm taking all of that in. Wow. So this is fascinating. Somebody, you're an agent or a former agent, as you said, suggested, why not mysteries? And I'm a huge, gigantic mystery dork myself. So I love that you write mysteries. What made you decide, even probably further back before you even thought about being a novelist, on the medieval period? What is it about the medieval period that sparks your zest for writing and for storytelling?
Well, I was raised by rabid Anglophiles, for one. we had tons of books on the shelves at home. And, you know, when you're a kid, you pull down the books to read that are there. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I was reading, obviously, above my level for a long time. And so there were a lot of books, medieval fiction, and textbooks and things like that, that I could, picture books of things I could pull down and look at. And it became a very interesting era that pulled me right in, because the pageantry, the clothes, the stratified society where everybody sort of had their level and place to be. It was very interesting to me. And so I just by osmosis sort of absorbed a lot of the history. Mm. And then, you know, later years, really went after researching it and just involving myself in reading about it. I did not get a history degree. I got an art degree. So, you know, because I was being practical and getting, I wanted a job. So history degree means that you're going to teach. So I didn't want to do that. It's just so fascinating, and people love reading about it because if it's a good historical novel, then you are learning some history. I don't recommend you learning history from a novel, but from a good one where it's well researched, you're getting that flavor, you're getting that touch of authenticity, of accurate things, and it should make you, and it does make people who are attracted to reading historically, it makes them interested in researching it themselves, and they do. So that's the fun part, and being part of that parade of authors that does write medievally historically. Is such a thrill, because then, you know, I get the feedback from readers that say, you know, I didn't know this about that. And you always want to include an afterword, because you are writing fiction, you want to make sure that they know that odd thing that they just read, that's true. You didn't make that up. You want them to know that, because if there is something that you tweaked, you want them to know that too. You don't want them walking away believing, you know, that this happened and that happened when it didn't. So, but you're always trying to keep the history true. You never change the history for you to suit your plot. You always have to change your plot to suit history. So.
Yeah. That's very true. And you know, it's interesting. In my first novel, which is an urban fantasy, it takes place in New York City. And I have a store. I have certain things that are real, obviously, that are in New York City, and certain things that this sort of vegan ice cream store at 87th and Amsterdam. And what's interesting, it's called The Jumping Cow. And what's interesting about it is how many readers contacted me after reading the book and going, went to 87th. And, yeah, where is The Jumping Cow? And I was like, that wasn't one other. So I realized that on my website, on the page for the book, I had to sort of detail, this is real, this is not real. And right. So when you're making those choices, when you're doing the research, as you said, you have to fit the plot to the history rather than the other way around. When you're writing this, what is your process for making those decisions as far as what the plot's going to be, what's going to be historically accurate, what are the things you're going to take liberties with? Can you talk a little bit about that process for yourself?
Well, I really do like to be faithful to the history. So when I come up with an idea for a story, in the Crispin books, it was sometimes the idea of the particular relic. So, you know, I start with that, research that, what makes it plausible to show up in London at this particular time. And then it sort of builds from there. Characters suggest themselves and all that. And how can I get the current politics into this particular story, or the particular politics of that year become the main part of the story? You know, it all depends on what, because the whole series, it's 15 books complete now. It starts at a certain date, and each consecutive book is another year in the time period. So, so each year suggests something that's happening in Richard II's reign. So sometimes that becomes important. So it's all these little things that might suggest themselves, or I want this particular kind of murder. How would that work in this particular thing? But since you mentioned urban fantasy, I've written that too. Urban fantasy, as does historical novels, require a certain amount of world building. You want to world build so that readers aren't lost. Mm-hmm. And urban fantasy is particularly good for that because the basis, the foundation is our world, the world we understand. So then the magic comes out of that. And it's the same thing when you're writing historically, because readers have a vague idea of what this time period is like, but not all the details. So you have to start building those little details into the narrative, into dialogue, into all of those, you know, want to info dump in the historical any more than you want to do in an urban fantasy. Like, okay, here, this is the kind of magic. There's elves, there's dwarves, there's things like that living under the bridge, the real bridges in New York. Now, here's a story. You want to do that. Nobody wants to read that. So you know that you have to do that certain level of research. No matter what you're writing, contemporary stuff, you still have to research it. I'm sure you had maps of New York in front of you. So you could start, you could name streets and subway stops and all that stuff. You want to be accurate, because I will tell you, readers out there will tell you when you're wrong.
For sure.
Happy to point those inaccuracies out, and bless them for that. So that makes you want to double down on your research to make sure that stuff's correct. And then, you know, it gives a reader a place to sort of rest and go, okay, I know that. I know about the street and I know about that castle. But we're going to see this now. We're seeing, a murder. And now we're seeing this character do that. And look, he's got this interchange going on with this lord that I've sort of vaguely remember from one history class somewhere. You know, so you're giving them all of that so they can involve themselves in the story without being bogged down.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and it's interesting. I was literally thinking, it's like when people talk about reincarnation, they go, "I used to be Catherine the Great." Well, everybody was Catherine the Great,
Everybody
right?
was Cleopatra, right?
Exactly. So, and it's so interesting to me because obviously we only know sort of the famous people, but you just said that it's a lord that they might have, you know, the whatever Shropshire, let's say, I don't know, Westshire. So they're the lord of such and such, and this was a historical figure, and your character would interact with that historical figure, it sounds like, and that wouldn't change the history, right? You wouldn't go through and modify what could have been
Right.
historically accurate, right?
Right. I like to think of my fictional characters with these fictional murders in them interacting because they could have run into these people. You have to make it so authentic that they could have. And in fact, one time, one of the people that is a real person, the Duke of Lancaster, John of Gaunt, who interacts a lot in the books because Crispin, my character, was once raised in his household, became a household knight, was knighted by him. And I remember researching John of Gaunt one day in one of the many great books, textbooks I was reading. And I kept, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, well, Crispin should be showing up here soon. And I'm going through pages going, and then I stopped myself saying, no, he's not going to show up in this book. He doesn't exist. He's not going to be in this research because he's not real, Jerry. But I had convinced myself that he was so entwined in his life, in this real person's life, that he was probably going to show up in the, you know, in the back information of the book. That's what you want your readers to do. The author needs to pull back a little, maybe drink a little less. I don't know, but that's you want it to be possible. You can't obviously have your fictional character marry a real person. That's not acceptable. But as an author, you have that contract with the reader that if you're calling something historical, that the history is right. And I get really touchy when people say, well, it's fiction. Can't you just make it up? Well, not for this, not
Right.
for something historical. You want to make sure that the reader is getting the enjoyment of learning a little history, but with these fictional characters taking them on this journey. But you have to have the history right. And I am a stickler for those things. And believe me, you don't want to sit in a theater with me watching an historical movie. I will be grunting and sighing and just,
Lots
throwing
of
my
eye
hands up.
rolling.
There's a lot of noise coming out of me and a movie because, or a TV show because they're never right, never.
That's so interesting. I mean, you would think, like in plays, you've got the dramaturges doing that kind of research, we hope. And someone who's making any sort of historical movie, unless they're deliberately telling an alternate history, you would hope that that would be the case as well. And yet it sounds like you, who know your history, probably look at it and go, yeah, that's not it. So what do you
Yeah.
do? What do you do in that case? Do you just grunt and leave it alone, or do you feel the need to address it sometimes?
Well, I do in when I'm doing lectures, I do lecture at some colleges and other areas about history and about, medieval history specifically. Other than that, I mean, what are you gonna do? You're gonna write the producer. I happen to know that a lot of these movies and television shows do hire consultants, so they can say they've consulted these medievalists And then they turn around and do exactly what they want.
Yikes.
So yeah, that is yikes. And it's unfortunate. I mean, especially today in the climate we are living in, where facts are so nebulous. And it, you know, it's just one more thing that it's just not good for a society to believe in too many things that aren't. I mean, fantasies are great. I like writing fantasy. Everybody knows it's fantasy. Nobody's being told that it's anything but that. But, you know, if you're writing something historically, you know, you want to be historically accurate, but then you don't, that makes it difficult for people to really understand what they're looking at, what they're absorbing. And some medievalists that I know who are professors of medieval history, and they have done this. They've said that there have been studies where they present like these historical medieval movies in their classrooms, and they talk about ahead of time what they're going to see and the inaccuracies that they are going to see. But what happens is, once these students have seen the movie, the things that stuck with them were all the inaccuracies. So that's a problem. So yeah, it's one of my big pet peeves.
It sounds, but it's you know, it's a viable pet peeve. I'm in your camp. And so when you're doing that, when you're in that position, it sounds to me like you're almost approaching some of this as a journalist. You know, let's get the what, who, where, when, how, why, and be factual.
Yeah, how, and I was a journalist.
Uh-huh. Well, there you go. So how does journalism fit into transitioning into someone who writes fiction?
Well, I'll tell you, there have been a lot of famous authors who were journalists ahead of time. That would be Mark Twain, and Edgar Allan Poe, and there's many others along the lines there. I recommend it highly to people who write fiction, because it helps you learn to cut to the chase. You've got only so many words to get the story out. It sort of has a beginning, middle, and end, not always, but you have to, in so many words, explain the story and get it out there. And that is a valuable lesson, because a lot of us, when we begin writing, use too much, too many words, too much narrative, too much to get to the story that we want to give to the readers. So it does help you do that. And it's also fascinating study of human nature. I can't tell you how many times I was interviewing somebody and they were telling me all sorts of things that they probably shouldn't have. And I kept wanting to say, but I wouldn't, you know, this is on the record. But so that, you know, that, it was amazing, because I don't know what they were thinking, but I guess they're thinking, you know, I'm an authority figure of some kind, so they can tell me. But anyway, so it was very interesting. And I did do that for years while I was trying to get my novels published. So it was a way to make money and learn a lot of things. And that was yet another thing I learned from high school, actually, high school journalism class, that I put into practice in real life. So thank you, high school classes.
I have a friend who ended up becoming editor of the Detroit News. I grew up in Michigan, and she was, you know, the editor of our high school newspaper. That's what she knew immediately, you know, for all of high school, she knew exactly what she wanted to do. And she ended up moving up the ranks until she was editor in chief of the Detroit News. And she just recently left. But the whole time, Kelly, we knew Kelly, this is what she was meant to do. You know, she said, I'm a storyteller, but I want to tell stories that are nonfiction. And And I thought, oh, brilliant. And she's a brilliant writer. And so, you know, to me, stories come in all shapes and sizes. But when you're talking about historical fiction or urban fantasy or some of your other series. These are not standalone books in that, yes, you can read just one, but probably you're going to want to continue. So you're doing long form storytelling. Mm-hmm. And talk to me, if you would, what is story to you? What's a good story? And how do you tell individual stories, but also that long narrative arc of 15 books?
Character. Character is king to me. Things like thrillers can be pretty cardboard characters because it's the action that's the exciting part of the book. Mm-hmm. That's the thing you're following along. There's a ticking clock. Something has to happen quickly. The resolution is, you know, the bomb not going off or the spy getting captured or whatever. But it's not about the character. It's about the plot. But mm-hmm. I like to write characters that are interesting because you're going to live with them for 300, 400 pages. And I want people to find them interesting. I like populating my books with interesting, all kinds of interesting characters, just like real people. It's like you encounter in your life. You've got tons of friends and interesting people that come in and out of your life. And that's realistic. And I want those characters to be realistic. So, my intention was when I was first venturing into publishing was writing historical novels that were standalone. But that wasn't working for me. So I knew to write a mystery meant that it had to be a series. So I wasn't used to writing the characters in another book. So that was challenging at first to see mm-hmm. if I could do that. And then I found that I do love this long form because as the series goes on, the characters change. Now in bygone era of novel writing and series writing, particularly, I guess, mysteries, because those are the usual series that you would find. The characters don't change. I mean, Hercule Poirot is the same from the first book to, well, almost last, but he doesn't change. He has no real past, really. And he doesn't change, so you can jump into the series anytime you want to, but that isn't possible anymore. Editors, readers don't like that. They like the character to change, not only from the first page to the last of one book, but throughout a series. They want them to grow and change. So it becomes the biggest novel ever that is 15 books long, because you're thinking of a character arc that could be a lifetime. This is 15 years in a character's life. And you think about your own 15 years and how much changes to you, around mm-hmm. you, and how those things have changed you. You know, you're not the same person you were 15 years ago. I should hope not.
I hope not.
I'm certainly not. And I don't know anybody who is. And so it really becomes such a fascinating thing to dip into, to this character that has come alive for the author, to find the different ways they can change. I personally like giving my characters likes and dislikes that are complete opposites of mine, so that I can really get into somebody else's shoes and think why this was a good choice, or why they enjoy this particular thing, or why they believe this certain thing. And especially historically, because their mindset is completely different than ours. Mm. We try to make them accessible to readers today, but for the most part, they have a very different way of thinking, having this stratified society that we as Americans don't believe in. We don't like that. We think anybody can do this or do that. But in this time period, you really do have to get yourself, it's like being an actor, really getting into character and figuring out their motivations and where does that motivation come from and what are the possibilities for them. For instance, I'm Jewish, but in England in this particular time period in the late 14th century, there were no Jews in England because they were kicked out in 1290. So they were gone, except some that might have remained secretly. So Crispin, in one of the books, he's just like everybody else, pretty much anti-Semitic, because he doesn't know anything about Jews except for what he's heard and blood libels and all of that. So it was interesting diving into this character, how he felt about these things, and how I could plausibly make him change and grow. So it's that sort of thing. Writing a series, I think, is some of the best, most interesting writing I've ever done. And I truly, truly enjoy it. And it was very sad to bring the series to a close, but I felt it was time to do that. And I'd always planned it anyway.
Again, I'm taking all of this in. I love your take on it. I'm an immigrant. I was born in the former Soviet Union, and I'm Jewish by heritage. And it's interesting the preconceived notions that even, you know, there in the Soviet Union in the 1970s versus medieval England. So something that
not necessarily versus either.
No.
Right along the line. I mean, you know, you could look at Nazi Germany, and the roots were there. They were building up from the medieval time period. We're talking 500 years of this building to that point. So, you know your history, folks, because you don't want to repeat it. And, you know, those roots are always there. And it's so it was fascinating, especially the blood libel idea. And if listeners aren't familiar with that, they believed the blood libels were that Jews during Passover, the wine that you drink at Passover was not wine, it was blood from Christian children. They would steal Christian children from the streets and kill them and use their blood for the Passover supper. And so it became tradition in some of the Eastern Bloc nations for the Jews who still lived there. I mean, I'm talking in the 20th century, to use white wine for Passover so that they could prove that they weren't, the tradition was that they were not using the blood of Christians drinking wine, even though in all the Jewish law, you're never to touch blood. You're never to drink it, never to touch it. But, you know, that's what a libel is. It's a lie. So I found that horrifying and fascinating that they still felt that they had to change the kind of wine they drank so they would not be accused of that.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. No, I remember freshman year of college, one of the women who lived on my floor in my dorm knocked and shyly asked if she could see my horns. And I was floored, wow. Right? So we had some educational moments about the fact that Jews do not have horns. But, it is interesting, though, how some of these, like you said, some of these notions are hundreds upon hundreds of years old, and yet we carry some thread of it to today. Mm-hmm. And when you're approaching that or attacking that as a writer, what are you trying to do? Are you trying to be faithful to the story, or are you trying to educate, or is it a combination of both?
Well, it is a combination of both, because it's a tradition of writers to comment about their current situation, contemporary life, and couching it in a historical setting, or even a few years ago, talking about the book MASH, the movie, the book, the TV show, MASH was about. It was set in the Korean War, but it was about the Vietnam War
sure.
that was going on right then. So it's a safe way to comment about things that happened in the past, but talking about what's happening right now. Even the Bible does this. If you look at some of the books like Daniel, they're not prophetic. Because they're not talking about something that might happen in the future. They're talking about something that already happened in the past, and they're warning you about these things in the writing of the past. So, I can talk about homosexuality, because that was something that you still had in the past. But it doesn't have the openness that we have now. So when you find an LGBTQ character, which I have in the series, who is a real person, I'm able to have him in the story to show people as a teaching moment that, yes, there were LGBTQ people in the past, always. And they lived lives just like everybody else.
Mm.
And, so there's all of these things that you can include. And I think it's always a teaching moment. I mean, you're there to entertain. I'm writing fiction. I want it to be entertaining. But, why not learn a little something at the same time? I mean, I learn it too. As I always research before I start writing, because it's some particular relic I'm writing about, or the people who are going to be in the book who are real people. There's always that research. And there's always research that continues while I'm writing, because as I come across things as I'm writing it, I think, did this exist then? Was this something people had? Were they doing it? So you always have to research at the same time. So it's all about the research. All about the research.
Amen. I'm really glad you started talking about when you write. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about what your writing routine is. Are you a plotter? It sounds like you kind of are, versus being a pantser. But also, do you write I'm going to write a book this weekend, or do you have a daily writing routine? What do you do to finish this many books?
Well, I'll tell you. It has evolved. So I don't want anybody to think there's any one way to do this, because there isn't. It's a whole variety of ways. I used to be a plotter. Everything had to be plotted out. And in the beginning, that was a good idea, because I have deadlines to meet. So you want to make sure that you can write a certain number of pages or word count every day. But as I got older and more experienced, I don't know, I decided that I just couldn't plot anymore, and I had to go by the seat of my pants, and I've enjoyed that too. So I really enjoyed just writing that way. And my whole routine has evolved, because I had a son who was growing up, and he was a little kid, and so you had to steal your time to write when he was napping, or when he was at school, or anything like, or doing stuff after school. And as he grew up and had his own life, and now of course he's 32 years old, and now he's a writer.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Screenwriter yet.
Wow.
He could have had a real career. Anyway.
I'm sure he's got a real career.
He does have a real career. And I'm so over the moon about him. I would, sit down. I got up in the morning and I commuted to my office in the next room. And
love those short commutes.
Those are great commutes, no traffic, except running into a cat occasionally. And do my emails and such first, because I'm in California. My agent and my publishers are in New York, and wanted to get the emailing and all that stuff out of the way, and then sit down and reread what I wrote the day before and edit it while I'm at it.
Mm.
And so that you can get into the rhythm of what it is you're writing. And I try at the end of my writing day not to leave it in a place where, yeah, I have a blank page all over again. You know, I want to leave it sort of in the middle of something that I was sort of really excited about writing, that mm-hmm. thing.
Mm-hmm.
So leave that so that I can get into it again. And I would pretty much read or write from 9 in the morning to sometime in the afternoon, I would stop. And, you know, that changes all the time, because sometimes I will write for an hour and stop for most of the day and get refueled by reading or watching a movie or something like that, and then write again, begin at 5 o'clock and write some more until 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock at night. So it just doesn't stay the same, because you're different. My poor little brain is different than it was that long ago, the early 90s, you know? And so you just have to go with it, you know, and I don't think people, writers put a lot of stress on themselves because they think that it should stay the same, that they have a routine to keep the routine going. They do word counts. They got it, you know, these notions of you have to do this and you have to do that. You can't. You can't maintain that. You can't stay the same. Bless you if you can, but, you know, don't kill yourself thinking that you're failing because you can't keep up that pace and that kind of schedule. You know, you gotta get out. You gotta get around and go outside. And when I was feeling a little blocked, not completely blocked, but a little, nothing was really happening very, very well, I would write in a different location in the house. Go outside and write. Sometimes just a different location, go to the library and write, helped get everything sparked up again. It made you feel like it was a job, you know, because, you know, having an office, a special dedicated space, is good for that, because this is my job, and I do need to dedicate my time to it. But sometimes you get used to your own office. And I have a lot of distractions in here. I have shelves filled with all kinds of crazy things. I have lots of medieval weaponry. I have, my son has been buying me these wonderful little figurines from the Hieronymus Bosch Garden of Earthly Delights. These little figurines are on the
wall. I love it.
They're bizarre. And I just have all kinds of crazy things in here to distract me that, you know, I sometimes cannot afford to be distracted. I need to get to work. But so I write in the kitchen, maybe, or out in the backyard, something like that. So all free advice to all the writers out there.
No, I absolutely agree. I go to work at the New York Public Library. That's where I write most of the time. I'll just make the trek out there and go up into the Rose Room and spend 5 hours writing. And it just feels it feels right and it feels good. And I think that's probably a big part of it.
I can't really write too much in a public space, because very often when I'm writing the medieval stuff, and there are sword fights, I like to act them out. So I don't think Starbucks would appreciate that.
Actually, you'd be surprised. I've acted out Aikido in Starbucks.
I bet they get my name right.
Yeah, I mean,
the sword, get her name right.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, my husband and I are both Aikido players, and one of my main characters in my latest book is an Aikido player. And And I have had him get up and we've done, and what's interesting about Starbucks here in New York City is people applaud, which I really like. They get into it themselves. So I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind, I know that you said that the Crispin guest books are over. What are you working on right now? What are the, if you can tease a little bit of something for somebody who's listening?
Well, I have pulled a book from my vault that I wasn't able to land with a publisher called Oswald the Thief. Excuse me. And that's it's Ocean's 11 in the Middle Ages. He's a con
I love it.
Excuse me. He's a con man and thief. And it's a humorous book. It's all first person. He breaks the fourth wall all the time. So it was a lot of fun to write. And he is getting together his gang for the big score at the Tower of London, stealing the crown jewels. I mean, you can't get a bigger score than that. So
no,
it was a lot of fun. So that will probably be released in May, getting it edited and all that stuff and getting a great cover for it. And with my agent is currently shopping a new series. It's called The King's Fool Mysteries. And my protagonist is Henry VIII's real court jester, Will Summers, as the amateur sleuth. And so that is a lot of fun because It's Tudor England. People love that. And an intimate of Henry VIII and all the court and what's going on with the politics, but he solves murder. So,
as a side gig,
he's got some free time. And, and so you get to do all the humor, researching Tudor humor. There's a lot of fart jokes. So I'm not warning right there.
And body, there's a lot of body jokes.
There's a lot of body jokes. And a little game you can play as a reader is you can try to figure out which ones were real and which ones I made up. And I bet you're wrong. So
my favorite one is Zwoons. I love it. So this
so
is great.
That's fun. And my agent is shopping that around and hopefully it'll land itself in a nice big publisher in New York.
Oh, that's great. I love, my husband was a professional clown, still is a professional clown, and he's got a real soft spot for
like, you know, clown. Interesting.
Circus clown way long ago, Aikido player much more recently. But okay. You know, but it is interesting to me how you're taking these historical people and transforming them, giving them new life or side gigs, I guess, in this book. Now, does Henry VIII himself play a role in the book, or
he is not tangential at all. He's in there front and center. And the fun part about it is, as we get into history and there are more television shows about these characters, Henry VIII and such, we know that he was not a good fellow. Mm. We know all of those things about him. But through Will's eyes, he loves him. He loves him warts and all. But, you know, he has to sway with the tide because we start with Catherine of Aragon. There should be supposed to be 6 books, one for each wife, possibly 9 books, one for each wife, plus all the 3 monarchs that come after Henry VIII, because Will lasted through Elizabeth I's reign as a court jester. Because he helped, you know, he was raising these kids too, and he loved them, and, you know, he was part of their lives. And, you know, he considers them his family now, because he was basically taken away from his family in Shropshire, and now he lives at court with Henry's family. So he's got to find a way to reconcile his love of Henry, but knowing the things he's doing is wrong. So it's a very interesting character study. Again, with characters, I love the characters. character study of a person of, that there isn't a lot of written history about.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we don't really know how old he was. We knew where he came from, but that's kind of about it.
Wow.
We don't know if he ever married. We don't know if he ever had kids. These are things that we do not know. So you can, which is kind of great, because then you can do what you need to do for this character and create them in your own head. So it's going to be a different look at Henry VIII that a lot of people are expect these days. So from through his eyes, so a different take.
Interesting. Yeah, Henry VIII and all the people around him are. They're fascinating figures. There's a musical out right now called Six.
Six, yeah.
Which I almost went to see last night and might go this weekend.
That'll be fun.
Yeah. It's like Hamilton, but
I've heard the
Wives of Henry VIII. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited to see it, but it is an interesting and fascinating time frame.
People love it. They love it.
Yeah,
absolutely. They never get tired of it. Never get tired of Anne Boleyn. Being in two books at least of the series, so
she was a smart woman. I used to work at the Maryland Renaissance Festival, and we've had Henry VIII as the king of the Renaissance Festival for, I don't know, 30 years, something like that. I mean, it's been a while. So, and they just keep recycling, you know, they keep going back and going, oh, we finished. Now we're going back to Catherine of Aragon because people love Henry VIII, that time period so much. Jerry, I'm so grateful you took the time to chat with me about this and about writing in general, about Crispin Guest, about Wilson. I'm like, come on, May. I can't wait to get my hands on the new book and read it, because I do have, like so many, have a huge love for that era. I was wondering, since I'm sure if you're listening to this, you probably want to know more about Jerry Westerson and Jerry's books. Jerry, would you mind giving me just a rundown of your social media, your website, everything like that, so if someone who's listening wants to buy a book or get in touch, that they can do that?
Well, it's jerrywesterson.com. It's the website. That's J-E-R-I, Westerson.com. And that'll get you most places. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. I've got a YouTube channel where I have a lot of book trailers on there, and lots of humorous videos that I put together. So there's a lot of content there. So please, you can sign up for that. Sign up for my newsletter. There's contests every month. So all kinds of fun things happen on that. And then you can find out about my events. And a lot of these are ending up on YouTube and Facebook, these book launches, so that anybody can go. You don't have to come to California. You can just sign on to YouTube and you can have probably be part of the fun as well and win some prizes.
That's awesome. Yes, thank you for doing that. People learn differently, so I always like to ask for the person to say what they are, but also all of that stuff will be in the show notes. You should definitely check out Jerry Westerson, obviously, because what cool books, right? Jerry, I again am super grateful that you took the time. I have just one last question, despite the fact that I could keep you here for the next 6 hours asking more questions, but I know you have a day to get back to and some more writing to do probably, but I was wondering if you wouldn't mind answering this. It's a question I ask everybody who comes on the show, and it's a weird little question, but I find that it yields some profound results. And the question is this: if you had an airplane that could skywrite anything for the whole world to see, what would you say?
Everybody chill. I think that's the message we need for today. Just chill, everyone. Just calm down. Hang out with everybody. Have a beer with them. Just talk. Be friendly. It's okay. Just chill. I thought you were going to, the question was, are you wearing pants during this interview?
I know you're not wearing pants.
A mystery.
That's right. I was going to say, I know you're not wearing pants. It's okay. I'm not wearing pants either. We're good.
Oh, good. We're pantsless buddies, man.
Right. I've been walking around in pajama bottoms for months. I don't know about anybody else. So, no, I am wearing pants. They're sweatpants, good. But I am wearing pants.
I'm
We, you and I are a strange buddy comedy waiting to happen.
We are. I'm ready to take this on the road.
That's it. Let's go. Oh, Jerry, thank you again so much for being here. I really appreciate it. What a great conversation.
This has been fun. Thanks. I love to talk about writing.
Yay. I hope you'll come back when more books come out so that we can talk even more and delve even deeper, both into the historical books and also the look at the alternative lens of history, of looking at history. I just love that. I think it's phenomenal. This is the Innovative Mindset Podcast, and I am Isolde Trachtenberg, your host. Remember, if you're liking what you're hearing, you can always buy me a cup of coffee at buymeacoffee.com/IsoldeT, or you can find the link on the show notes. You're going to be able to find the links to all of Jerry's information, not all of it, but you know what I mean, the socials, the website, maybe even a book cover or two, depending on what I can ask from Jerry. And until next time, I, as always, remind you to be bold, be creative, and most of all, be kind. Thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate you being here. Please subscribe to the podcast if you're new, and it would mean the world to me if you told a friend about it. Today's episode was produced by Isolde Trachtenberg and is copyright 2022. As always, please remember this is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Past performance does not guarantee future results, although we can always hope. Until next time, remember to be bold, be creative, and most of all, be kind.